to our origin of We the People. Tackling current issues, both political and legal, with common sense. As We the People, we must bring common sense back to make our lives better. Only on Now Media TV.
Good evening and welcome to We the People. Tonight we begin with Cuba, not as a headline, but as a reality that demands clarity. Because right now, just 90 miles from the United States, an entire country is in crisis. A nationwide blackout has left millions without power. No electricity, no refrigeration, no reliable access to water. And this is not an isolated failure of the electrical grid there in Cuba. This is the third major collapse of Cuba's electrical grid in recent months. This is not just an outage. This is a systemic breakdown, the kind that builds over time under policies that restrict, control, and centralize power until eventually the system can no longer sustain itself. And when this happens, it is the people who suffer first. Families are unable to preserve their food. Communities struggling without water, hospitals operating under strain and having to cancel life-sustaining treatment. But even within this crisis, there is something more troubling. There is a divide. Because while much of the country sits in darkness with spoiling food, no running water, no access to life-sustaining medicines, there are certain areas in Cuba that are not affected at all or minimally. You wonder, where could that be? Well, look to the tourist districts, to the famous resort zones of the beaches where, ironically, the Cuban people themselves are not allowed to use. Facilities tied to government leadership or the homes of the elite government class continue to receive prioritized electricity. All the while, the 11 million people of Cuba, the vast majority, are plunged into darkness. Even hospitals that primarily serve tourism and elite officials have electricity and remain powered, while the ordinary Cubans are left without basic access. So this is not just about a shortage. It is not about decision-making, and it is not about, oh, the United States embargo of 67 years. It is about a system making decisions, an elite tyrannical regime that has shown over and over again their dissension for the people. And they're choosing who gets access and who does not. And that distinction is what matters. While people here in the United States are saying, oh, no more kings and all of that, look to just 90 miles off the coast of Florida, and you will see what a true tyranny looks like. Because this crisis is not occurring in a vacuum. For decades, Cuba has operated under a centralized state-controlled regime while also facing external economic pressure from the United States. What are those? Sanctions, trade restrictions, isolation, embargo? There are those who argue those external pressures are the root cause of what we're seeing today. However, let's remember that many countries have also been doing business with Cuba. Cuba's main oil support has been Venezuela until such time as Maduro was taken out by the U.S. surgical operation, both military and joint with the Department of Justice, FBI. But, you know, you cannot blame this solely on the U.S. embargo because also, for those people who may not know, the U.S. embargo had exceptions. And the exemptions were medicine, food, hospital equipment. But yet somehow the government had all of that equipment and medicines and things that were life-sustaining went to the elite, went to the touristism, went to the beautiful hospitals that the regular people of Cuba are not allowed to attend. Sanctions do not decide who gets what in Cuba. Sanctions do not decide who gets electricity, who gets access to proper medical care, which neighborhoods receive electricity. They do not decide which hospitals stay open and which go dark. Those decisions are made internally. And that brings us to the larger question, not just about the infrastructure that has been aging since the revolution of Fidel Castro, but it's about the governance, the leadership, the absolute disregard for the very people that were supposedly going to be the ones saved by Fidel in the revolution. Because when a government can no longer provide the basic necessities for its people, electricity, food, stability, water, people don't just endure indefinitely. They begin to question. And in Cuba, we have been seeing that question arising more and more. See, we have to look at this historically, because remember, Fidel is, you know, the year of the revolution is 67. And that's how they date their documents, by the way. This was supposed to be, you know, bringing wealth equality. And stop me if this is starting to sound a little familiar, people. Because it was supposed to be about making sure that the wealthy pay their fair well, bringing justice and wealth equality among the masses. Now, I will give something to Castro. Literacy and education had improved, especially among the rural areas of Cuba, but also the disaster that resulted after this revolution, because they nationalized everything. And that's where you see this crisis really glare, the spotlight on the crisis. The glaring issue is that you have an infrastructure that has not modernized whatsoever since 1950s. You have where other countries, whether they're third world countries or not, have been adding alternative sources of electricity or how to garner the electricity. Cuba has been stuck with a 1950s model infrastructure that is highly dependent on crude oil. And their main source was Venezuela, with a little bit from Mexico. And that is where we're seeing this. Now, can you say that it's definitely been a stranglehold since Maduro was taken out? Since the U.S. has been applying more pressures on Venezuela and Mexico, ensuring that no oil goes to Cuba? Absolutely. There is a direct correlation. But that's also because for the first time in, I believe, 17 presidents, we have a president that is actually committed to the downfall of a tyrannical, abusive regime. And let's not sugarcoat this. This regime, long since Castro, since the beginning, has been having human rights violations left and right. Political prisoners, which we are now seeing some political prisoners being released. Some of the same people that were out in protest by the tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, throughout Cuba, that we witnessed one of the largest protests in 2021. What we're seeing is very nice to see that the president and I say that in quotes, the president of Cuba looks very refreshed in saying this. And the elites of the government are very refreshed when they're stating what can happen and what they're open to. But what you're seeing here is nothing more than the final tipping point, or so many hope and believe, the final tipping point that we can finally have a free and democratic Cuba, one that goes back to the original constitution. So you have to recall that Cuba obtained its freedom, its independence from a Spanish empire back in 1902. Now, Bautista subrogated the democratic constitution. But Bautista was also for capitalism. You do not have capitalism in Cuba. You do not have a way for the Cubans to be able to thrive. So the lesson is, when a system fails this visibly, the issue is no longer just survival. It becomes accountability. When we come back after this commercial break, we're going to look at what happens when the people of Cuba begin to demand it, demand the accountability, demand their rights, demand their freedom. Because this is what many of us who have personal connections to this little island 90 miles off of Florida are resting with. And also for those who are desiring the freedom of other people. Tune right back in to We the People. Welcome back. What we're seeing in Cuba right now is not just a humanitarian crisis. It is a political moment, but one that could be very epic. Like I stated in the last segment, we are seeing a true tipping point. This is a country that has been under the Castro Revolution, whether it was communism and then this nationalism, but it's been the same Castro who has been tyrannical. And even though he died in 2016, it retained that tyranny, that mindset. But this is a moment. The reporting coming out over the past several days from differing areas of Cuba makes it very clear that we are witnessing what could be a complete falling of a regime that has been in power for 67 years. This is not just about one blackout or three. This is about a system under visible strain, about the people at a breaking point. Recent reports describe widespread desperation across the island. This is not isolated incidents. Havana, the capital that usually has more resources pumped to it, is now starting to feel the strain. We are starting to note a pattern. People standing in long lines for food. People without running water, having to wait with plastic jugs at the center of town's fountains. Basic goods becoming harder to find. Fuel shortages disrupting transportation and daily life. And perhaps most telling, a rise in what's being described as unusual acts of defiance. Defiance by the people, protest, something that this Cuban regime has stamped out over the decades that they have been in control. Because remember, the Cuban regime does not allow for the people to show dissidence, because if the people are uniting, that means they could be overthrown. That's also why the diaspora, or the worms, as the Cuban exiles, the Cuban refugees, those that were able to escape, have been so affectionately referred to by this Cuban regime are not allowed to have any part of the economy, or at least it hasn't. Language matters, because in Cuba, public defiance is still rare. For decades, dissent has been totally controlled, contained. How? Arrest, taken political prisoner, death. This is not a regime that does not have any qualms with assassinations or unjust imprisonment. And yet now, according to multiple reports, seen in videos, people are pushing back in ways that are increasingly visible. We're seeing protests on the street in the middle of the night, people hammering pots and pans to make noise of their dissent of what is happening. Public complaints are becoming louder and louder. People are no longer afraid to voice their opinions in recorded videos. Communities expressing frustration even more so by attacking the communist headquarters, taking out furnishings, files, and burning them in the street. This isn't because the risk of retaliation by a tyrannical regime is gone. By no means. It's just that the pressure has reached to a different level, to the point that the pressure cooker is singing. It is now erupting. And that pressure is not just coming from one place. It is coming from multiple cities throughout the island. Because now we have an infrastructure failure. We have an absolute strain on the economy. And we have a population that is increasingly aware that the system is not delivering, that the system that is supposed to be beholden to the people is now even further failing them. All the while, like we discussed earlier, the choice is to make sure that all of the resources are funneled to one particular sect, whether that's the resort islands, the beaches, and the elite. And there is a very active narrative, particularly outside of Cuba, that this crisis is primarily the result of U.S. policies, especially those that have been even more implemented since what the U.S. did to extract Maduro from Venezuela in January. That an embargo, U.S. sanctions, that it is this administration that's the driving force behind what we are seeing. And we see people like, Thunberg, the little girl who's the environmentalist, people who are out there screaming in protest to support a malicious regime, not in favor of the people. And those policies do matter. They do limit access to certain resources. They do increase economic pressures, but that is what we're doing, because we now have an administration that is putting a full front effort to bring down a regime and bring democracy back to an island that was once, prior to Castro, thriving. Yes, there are so many improvements, but to bring back democracy, to bring back economic freedom to the very people, you only have to look at what was happening just since 2020. 2 million people fled from Cuba. Vast majority of them are working age, youthful people. You saw it in the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, the Marielo Rotless. This is not a country that is thriving. This is a country that has its people suffering. And this is where reporting, like from mainstream media, which you don't hear much about anything on mainstream media, is really critical. Because within Cuba, the crisis is not affecting everyone equally. We are seeing clear indications that resources are being prioritized. Tourist areas, resort zones, parts of the economy tied to foreign revenue, even though tourism, which is a major economic incentive for the Cuban government, it does bring in dollars, has been waning because of the lack of jet fuel. But, you know, I always personally love the videos of the poor tourists that are in Cuba and these beautiful beaches and the resorts wondering if they're going to be able to fly home. But yet no concerns to the very people that are working at those resorts. And the only time those people see fresh water and electricity is while at work, they go home to darkness, to food, garbage, rotting in the streets. Ordinary neighborhoods experience prolonged outages. Now some of them are just 24 hours. Before January, before the extraction, you know, the capture of Maduro, Cuba was already dealing with electrical outages because of a failed infrastructure. They were dealing with 20 hours of no electricity. But now it's getting even more so. So where does the conversation go to become more honest? The external pressure does not determine who gets power and who does not. The external pressure does not determine whether this, and maybe it will. Maybe this is what we need. Maybe this is what the people have been screaming for back in 2021, as well as those that are here that have been saying this change has to go. This is what, because maybe finally the pressure is going to be so much that there will be true change. But one thing's for sure, the regime, the president of Cuba is making sure to make the decision of who gets power. And those tourists are not being affected as much. Those elites are not being affected as much. Their medical care, their hospitals are not being affected. Not in the proportions that the regular people are. There are increasing discussions about opening the economy carefully to outside investment, including from the gusanos, the worms of the Cuban diaspora that are now most majority of them in Miami or in Florida. And that tells you something. It tells you that the system is under pressure and that they're now willing to open it up. But at what end? Because this government has also allowed the gusanos to, if they invest in Cuba, they must become residents of Cuba, which, again, with a corrupt regime as it is, doesn't give any safeguards to anybody in making an investment in Cuba because they can easily take it. They nationalize everything. So we have to be strategic. We are seeing a shift in the political conversation here in the United States with renewed discussion about whether this moment represents an opportunity to push for a real change in Cuba, including rhetoric suggesting the possibility of a stronger U.S. involvement to make and force a change. But that change isn't coming quickly enough. What are we witnessing? Is it the beginning of the end of this system that has been in place for 67 years? This is the real question. And right now in Cuba, you can see all those elements at play. We're going to be right back and we're going to discuss what these options are that the Cuban government is now floating. Tune right back in to We the People. Welcome back to We the People. As Cuba faces mounting pressure, economic, political, and now infrastructural, a new development is beginning to emerge, and it is one that deserves very close attention. Because for the first time in decades, the Cuban government is signaling openness to allowing members of the Cuban diaspora, you know, the very worms as they were described, to invest in businesses on the island, removing the requirement that you have to become a resident of Cuba. Let's pause on that. Because historically, this would have been unthinkable. Fidel would always castigate those that left and fled Cuba from the 60s, the 70s, the 80s as gusanos and other probably wonderful, beautiful choice words that cannot be stated. Never would he have allowed or was open to the idea that Cubans, exiles, those that fled would be able to invest in Cuba. Much less at one point, you couldn't even return. Many of these people, like my own parents, were not able to return so that they could visit family or respect the dead. And much of those same Cubans that fled in the 60s, the 70s, and the 80s, and even now, all of their property were seized by the government. For generations, those who left Cuba, many of whom built lives and businesses here in the United States, were not invited back into an economic structure of that country. In fact, the system was designed to limit exactly the kind of outside influence, because just like when the people rise and organize against the government, that is a threat to this regime. So is outside economic influence and outside influence and investors. Private ownership is still restricted. Foreign participation is tightly controlled by this government. And yet now, because of this extreme embargo, because of the pressures that this government is feeling, the Cuban government is feeling, we are starting to see a shift in their conversation. Let's put it that way. Because according to the reports that are coming out, the Cuban government is actively exploring ways to allow exiles and diaspora communities to participate economically in Cuba, to invest, to open businesses, to own real estate, to own real property in Cuba, and to inject capital into a struggling system. That tells you something. When the president and his cabinet administration are stating this on the news, relating this on the radio, because the television now can't be really worked. Because governments do not make moves like this unless the pressure is getting so intense, there is no other way. But don't be fooled, because you got to remember, these same people in the U.S. government cannot be trusted, because they're going to say, yes, bring your investments. Yes, you can own real estate, and we're not going to make you become residents, at least for the Cuban exiles. But there will be attachments. There will be strings. And right now, the U.S. government is stating that Marco is not having any conversations with Fidel's grandson, who's a Castro. And we got to look at this. There is a failing power grid. There are ongoing shortages. There is such a decreased economic output. And the population is under increasing pressure and is starting to stand up for itself. It's starting to protest and show its disdain for what is happening. So we're going beyond a policy evolution. We're looking at what is going to be the actual response. Is there going to be an actual shift or evolution from this current regime that has been empowered since 1959? So what kind of response are we going to see? Because there's two ways to interpret what we're seeing coming out of Cuba. One is that this represents the beginning of meaningful reform. Open capitalism, maybe a quasi-capitalist system like what we see in communist China. A recognition that the current system is no longer sustainable for the people. And an opening of an economy that is stepped toward broadening its resources, broadening the change within. But yet there's the other interpretation. And this is the one we can't ignore. We cannot put blinders or rose-colored glasses. This is not about reform. It's about preservation. Is this just a lure, a way for this regime, for this autocracy to continue? Because history has shown us authoritarian systems can adapt economically without relinquishing political control. All you have to do is look to China. They can allow limited private enterprise. They can invite outside capital. They can make targeted adjustments, all the while maintaining the same centralized authority, the same control, and the same limits on the freedom to the very people that are on that island. And when you look at the reporting around this potential shift, that is exactly the tension being raised. Is this an opening, or is this just strategy? Because allowing the diaspora investment does not automatically mean allowing independent power. It may simply mean bringing in resources while keeping control exactly where it has always been. It is just allowing the people to come in, grabbing that U.S. dollar, but there is no way. And then they could shut that door as quickly as they opened it. For many Cuban Americans, this is not just policy. This is very personal. I can tell you, my own father, he was protesting for the change of this regime back in 1970, in early 1970. This is deeply personal, especially for those who have families still in Cuba. This is about generations who rebuilt their lives here in US and other countries. This is about a people who understand both what Cuba was and what it could be. It's about the new generations, those of us that are first gen US citizens, those that are maybe even second generation, who always held on to what the parents would tell us, or our grandparents' stories of what Cuba once was, and with visions and hope of what it could become. And it's not about a property grab or disenfranchising the very people. It's about hope for a democracy, hope for a freedom of the people, and hope for dignity to be restored to the very 10 to 11 million peoples of Cuba. So should the diaspora come back and invest? You can't say yes or no. It's not as simple as that. Because the real question is, under what conditions? Will there be real ownership? Will there be real autonomy? Will this allow the very people in Cuba to have autonomy over their own finances, under their own businesses, under the growth? Will they be free from severe taxes where they are making, what is it, on average $7 a month to $15 a month? Where will there be protections, and what are those protections? And will participation exist? And will that be within the boundaries set by this regime, or will it be truly free? And that's where it matters, that distinction right there. Is it true freedom, or is it bound by that regime? Because it determines whether this moment leads to transformation. Now, just because the Cuban government is saying this, we still have, at least those of us in the U.S., have, you know, we are restricted, we are prohibited from doing so. But let's just say those prohibitions were gone. What does this really mean? Because the diaspora will not be investing in Cuba if it means reinforcing an existing system that has been an absolute disaster. Historically, Cuba has been here before, not in this exact form, but in the moments where economic pressure forced limited opening. And each time the question has been the same. Does economic flexibility lead to political change? It has not done so in the past because all it did was extend the life of the current system. And that is where we are again, a system under pressure, making calculated adjustments while holding tightly to control. And that is what is not endurable. We cannot allow that to happen because what comes next for Cuba is the lens we have to use. Cuba is standing at a crossroads between adaptation and transformation, between control and the possibility of change. And the people, the exiles, have hope that they may once again be able to rebuild their Cuba. But what happens when those same questions about leadership, loyalty, trust start to emerge in our own political system? That's what we're going to be taking on next. Tune right back in after this. Welcome back to We the People. Tonight we've been talking about Cuba, about what happens when a government holds power, even as its people suffer. But here's the uncomfortable truth. Pressure doesn't only exist in failing regimes. It exists anywhere. People begin to question leadership. And right now we're seeing that happen inside Trump's base. MAGA. We are actually starting to see it even more so. And not as a theory, but in real time. Because over this past several days, if not several weeks, the reporting has been cleared that there is a growing divide among Trump supporters. Actually, there's a growing dissent among those that have been staunch Trump supporters, the MAGA, if you will. And it is being driven by one issue in particular, foreign policy. Specifically, how the United States should respond to initiating conflict involving Iran. See, now you have a split. Because remember, many of those in MAGA are saying, make America great again. They want the focus solely on America, on the United States' interests, and how to improve the economy here, how to make things more affordable, and also about, in a way, more of an isolationist mentality. And so those are like, wait a minute, why are we attacking Iran? Why are we getting involved in regime changes in Cuba, Venezuela? So you have on one hand, voices pushing for strength, for innovation, for a more aggressive posture among those supporters of Trump, stating that with this, it directly benefits the U.S. because of the security, about the fact that we're preventing a regime like Iran obtaining nukes that bring democracy and having regime changes in our southern neighbors here in our Western Hemisphere is actually a benefit. And then, on the other hand, you had the influential figures within the MAGA movement, podcasters like Tucker Carlson, commentators, insiders, they are pushing back. And what you're seeing is like a full-on attack. Warning against escalation, questioning the direction, and in some case, breaking publicly with decisions they disagreed that Trump is making, and in fact, even putting the blame, laying the blame on Israel, stating that we're fighting Israel's war. And they are not being subtle. And it's not a theoretical conversation of what ifs and things like that. This is not the Socratic method. And one of the clearest examples of a dissent that is growing among some people that have been staunch supporters of Trump, those that have been, I mean, right by his side, has occurred right now. And that is involving Joe Kent. Joe Kent, who just resigned from his post in the intelligence department. A figure closely aligned with Trump, a national security voice, and someone who stepped down amid growing controversy and internal pressure because his opposition to what is occurring in Iran. And what is followed? Just as telling, a prominent voice within the MAGA ecosystem who is not staying quiet. Because prominent voices are reacting. And they are defending Trump, and they are criticizing, and they are debating publicly. That matters. Because for years, this movement has been defined by alignment, keeping it together. And you, I mean, yes, there were some ebbs and flows and maybe some stretches, but never before have we seen so visibly the disagreement that is growing louder and louder among those that were once the staunchest supporters. And it's not stopping there. Commentators, longtime supporters, now openly saying the movement is losing its direction or staying from its, or straying from its original principles. And others are just doubling down on their support, doubling down on MAGA and Trump and what he's doing. And what I love too, I have to say, because it just popped in my head. Then you have Senator John Fetterman, who seems to be a voice of reason, and he is not MAGA, about why, what is occurring in Iran, what we're doing there does benefit the U.S. But that's not what we're talking about today. What we are watching on TV, what we're seeing from podcasters, those like the Tucker Carlsons and Joe Kent, are not leaving quietly. So the argument is being very much a public, being present very publicly. And so it's the question has to be asked, is the movement over? Is this what is going to finally cause the MAGA movement to dissolve? Will this be another schism of a party? That is really what we need to be evaluating, because this isn't about loyalty disappearing. It's about being tested. So Karl Rove also stated that Trump isn't losing his supporters. It is healthy to question what a leader is doing. I implore all Americans, that is our right. We get to question those that are in government, those that are elected leaders, those that are supposed to be doing what is in the best interest. We are supposed to question. We are supposed to be able to debate whether what is happening is good. But it is interesting to see that just, was it a year and a half ago? We saw these very same people out there stomping for Trump, totally back, and now, now, is that also because all they want is views, clicks, because it brings up and drives more revenue to them? You can't blame them. That is their business. So maybe not being somebody who's a yes man is there. But one, and though they, you see in the polls that there are certain shifts within certain groups, the core base, core central base of Trump supporters is still remaining very strong. But outside that base, independents, younger voters, especially Gen Z males, that support is starting to wane. Their confidence is being, their confidence is waning, is softening. And that the polls are showing, that there is that shift. And this is important because it's not necessarily because of Trump, because Trump is, you know, this is his last term. But it is an indicator of what is to be expected, and it should be ringing some major alarm bells and flags should be raising for the Republican Party, because this will have an effect in the midterm elections. Now, again, there are other factors. I mean, we do have a government shutdown because, once again, the Democrats are shutting down everything to try to push their agenda. We've been here before. Now we're seeing it even worse because now you have TSA not showing up. But when you have the likes of Tucker Carlson saying, you know, coming out saying that this is a war for Israel, putting it all on Israel, which is actually shocking. Somebody who has been very vocal of his disdain as to what's been going on by Netanyahu. But then you have those like Karl Rove, who has been very much an advisor or a confidant of Trump, saying it is not over. So this really isn't the end of the MAGA movement, but we should see what the internal strain really has. And what is really interesting about this debate that's occurring within this group is what direction does it take? And then where the influence is being tested. Where voices that once moved in lockstep. I mean, it used to be if you criticized Trump, you were ousted. People stopped talking to you. So now you're starting to see that testing, which it happens in every group. But you see, what we witnessed with Trump was not just a political voting bloc. He actually created a movement. And so the question is it moving differently? Is there going to be a schism? And I state that this is where real change begins, because this is the breakdown. As far as the people who have been screaming, drain the swamp, that the current system is broken, and it is broken. The current way our Congress is run is broken. The way our government has been running is broken because nobody is willing to talk to each other. So maybe this is a way of shaking up the system. And it's not just for MAGA. I'm talking on for Democrats, for independents. We the people need a shakeup, because we the people deserve a hell of a lot better than what has been coming out of D.C. Movements don't fracture when people walk away. They fracture when people start disagreeing out loud. And that is truly what is going to be the test here. So let's step back. Let's connect this to everything we've discussed tonight. In Cuba, you're watching people begin to push back against the system after decades of control. Here in the US, you're watching a political movement begin to debate itself in real time. But the same underlying truth, when pressure builds, when expectations shift, when people start to question, everything changes. From Havana to DC, one truth remains. Power does not belong to government. It belongs to the people, those that are resilient enough to stand up for themselves. And when the people begin to question, demand what is right, what is fair, to demand that the leaders that are elected are actually governing and representing those that they are meant to, and not just their own lobbyists, not those that give them money, not just because they fall within progressive or MACA, but to all. That is when true change occurs. I'm Alina Gonzalez-Dockery. Thank you for joining me another night on We the People. Good night.